Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by our news editor, Jordan Farley.
Hello.
And our reviews editor, Matthew Leyland.
Howdy.
Howdy. So this week we're looking at Taika Waititi's Thor Love and Thunder, Dakota Johnson's Persuasion, and British comedy Brian and Charles. And we'll also be talking to Brian and Charles themselves, David Earle and Chris Hayward. But first of all, what have you guys been watching this week that aren't those three films? Jordan?
Well, I caught the second part of Stranger Things 4 this weekend, both episodes, totaling something like 4 hours, incredible length for two episodes of TV. And I very much enjoyed it. I have to say there's been a bit of a backlash against Stranger Things 4, I think, because of its sheer sort of length and scope. But I actually quite enjoyed most of this season, to be honest. And it sort of delivered everything I wanted from Stranger Things at this point, which is mainly just monsters and 80s nostalgia. I didn't think it put a foot wrong in that sense. More Kate Bush as well, which, you know, is never a bad thing.
Yes, indeed. I'm clueless about all of this. Matthew, what have you been feasting your eyes on?
Stranger Things as well. I haven't quite finished yet.
I've watched not a single episode of it, ever.
I found that mad. Before the first season came out, it was like your most anticipated show ever, because it was like we're known as Return.
Yeah, I was massively into the idea of it. And then for some reason, I don't know, I didn't see the first one or two, and then I kind of just missed everything, and I've missed it all. And it's on my list with the other things I need to watch.
You don't want to be a Johnny come lately either. That's just uncool.
Well, I am. Yeah. I will be. There's no avoiding that now, Jordan. I am. Okay. Shall we crack on then and talk about what we can watch on the big screen instead of the small screen?
Yeah.
Time to bring the thunder. It's this.
Kids, get the popcorn out.
Let me tell you the story of the space Viking,
Thor Odinson. He was no ordinary man. He was a god.
After saving planet Earth for the 500th time, Thor set off on a new journey.
Well, he got in shape. He went from dad bod to god bod. And after all that, Mjolnir, he reclaimed his title as the one and only Thor. Oh, spoke too soon.
Jane?
So this is Thor, Love and Thunder, another Marvel film. Is it marvelous, Jordan? Tell us what this one's all about.
I thought it was completely marvelous, not to jump the gun. I very much enjoyed this one. But yeah, this is the fourth solo outing for Thor Odinson. It's a sequel to Endgame. It sort of picks up about 4 years after the events of that film. Thor is still traveling the galaxy with the Guardians, the Asgardians of the galaxy, if you will, now that Thor is amongst their ranks. He has gone from dad bod to god bod. He's kind of trimmed down, buffed up. And in that time, he sort of lost his way a little bit. The losses that he suffered in Ragnarok and Infinity War and Endgame, the loss of Loki, the loss of Asgard, the loss of Mjolnir, of course, they've taken their toll. And he's sort of suffering a bit mentally, even though physically he's sort of at the top of his game. And then one day he receives a message from across the stars by a fellow former Asgardian. Who alerts him to the existence of a person called Gore, the God Butcher, who is played by Christian Bale in this film. He, as the name implies, is a killer of gods. He is on a kind of one-man mission to slay every living deity in the universe because he has a grudge against the gods for reasons which we won't go into in great detail here, but are explained in the film. So this message from across the stars, it sort of sends Thor to New Asgard, which is back on Earth and being ruled by King Valkyrie, of course. New Asgard has now become this sort of tourist hotspot, and there's some cruise ships docked off the shore. Valkyrie is hawking like old spice and things like this in quite amusing fashion. And this also brings him back into the orbit of Jane Foster, who was, of course, Thor's ex from the first two Thor films. Didn't feature in Thor Ragnarok, but did pop up briefly in Endgame, you may remember, from unused footage from Thor the Dark World. And in the time since they've broken up, mysteriously, Jane Foster has been bestowed the power of Thor. She is now wielding Mjolnir, which has reformed somehow. And now there are two Thors. There's the mighty Thor, Jane Foster, and there is the OG Thor, Chris Hemsworth. And they essentially set off across the stars on a mission to stop Gore before he can hurt anyone else.
So there's a lot going on. Jane's back. Jane is awesome. You know, I do like a Jane with a mighty hammer in her hand, as having held Mjolnir on the set of Thor the Dark World. I feel like I'm like the trailblazer here. They saw me in my red parker. They thought, you know what? I think we should do this later. Let's talk about Jane and her return. What does that dynamic do to that? And also the other, like, very amusing little newcomers in this world. Like, I'm thinking Russell Crowe. What did you think of Jane, and what did you think of Russell?
I really like them both. I have to say I especially liked Russell Crowe, who essentially fills the Jeff Goldblum role from Ragnarok in this film, where he's a sort of extended cameo, but he is absolutely hilarious.
So good.
He plays Zeus, the god of lightning, I guess. I don't actually know what
he's the god of all the gods on Mount Olympus. He's like
the old god of all the old gods.
The big OG god.
So yeah, Anthony Hopkins is the old father. He's the old god. But yeah, he's just this complete preening buffoon who just seems like more interested in like orgies and his followers and things like that. He speaks in this Greek accent, which I just thought was absolutely pitch perfect. Just every line out of his mouth was just leaving me in hysterics. I thought he was so good. Not in it as much as I would have liked, perhaps, but yeah, very, very enjoyable. And then Natalie Portman, I enjoyed similarly, but for slightly different reasons. I don't think she quite has the comic chops that Hemsworth and Russell Crowe sort of demonstrate in this film, but she does do much better work with sort of some quite affecting dramatic scenes, sort of especially towards the end. If you're familiar with Jason Aaron's Mighty Thor comic run, you'll probably know the direction that this character arc is going in. But for others, I won't quite spoil where they take it because they haven't been talking about that in, you know, all the pre-release publicity. But I thought physically she looked absolutely fantastic. I love her costume. She has
a great wig.
Swole. A great wig, great biceps. just the whole thing is terrific. And I really enjoyed the fact that she's sort of new to the superhero game. So the whole time she's kind of workshopping catchphrases and she's kind of deciding what her whole deal is going to be. So she feels like a little bit of a work in progress. So I thought Natalie Portman actually pitched the performance pretty perfectly.
Yeah.
The one thing I was slightly disappointed by was the fact that because it starts off as this side, you know, awkward exes coming back together and then rekindling their romance, as it often is in a sort of rom-com. You sort of don't just get enough of Thor and Jane together for a lot of the film because they're sort of distracted by the mission that they're on and these various other characters coming in. It's really not until the sort of final act, the final third, that they come together and you get that, the resolution and just the screen time together that you want them to have. So the film felt a bit lopsided to me in that sense, but I thought Jane was a really great return addition to this cast.
Yeah. And Russell Crowe, I love the fact that he's sending up his gladiator sort of image as well. Like he's wearing a similar sort of outfit to the gladiator, but he's sort of prancing around with his skirts up. And of course, you know, like he legendarily wanted to do gladiator in a Spanish accent because he was supposed to be a Spanish centurion and he wasn't allowed to. He had to do it in that classic, you know, RP. So this really does feel like him really taking the piss out of his own image, which I really enjoyed seeing. Matthew, let's talk about there's also jealousies going on, not just between Thor and Jane, but there's jealousies of weapons going on here. That's rather amusing. Did you enjoy that?
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, Stormbreaker and Mjolnir, they've become characters unto themselves, especially like the way Thor speaks to them, which kind of adds another amusing layer to the movie. And yeah, Stormbreaker's nose, if it has a nose, is kind of put out of joint by the return of Mjolnir and the worship of it that's going on around it. But it does get to play quite a vital part in the movie as well. So it's not, maybe Thor is perhaps shoving it to the sidelines, but the plot doesn't. So if you enjoy Stormbreaker, there's plenty of that to go around. But actually, I mean, there's loads of weapons as well. I mean, Zeus has his lightning bolt. So we get to see that in quite a lot of action, and Valkyrie's arm to the teeth at all times.
Thor has his necro sword as well.
So let's talk about Gore. I mean, this is Christian Bale, who, you know, his image is one of a very serious actor. This is what we know of him. And yet, he's really funny in this, as well as being terrifying. There's this brilliant scene where he's got a load of children of Asgard and he's telling them what he thinks is a sort of child story. And it involves sort of decapitation of a small creature and just terrifying the hell out of them. It's a really difficult line to walk, that, isn't it? And he totally nails it. Did you enjoy Christian Bale joining this world?
Yeah, I absolutely loved it. I think he's one of the best villains that Marvel have had for quite a while, actually, certainly since Thanos. Yeah, I just thought walking that tightrope that he does between humor and outright fear was just so expertly judged, the whole thing. He's such a, like a little weird goblin, like he's just saying such strange random things in his expressions, and just the fact that he's able to be completely terrifying and hysterically funny just almost in like the same lines sometimes, I thought that was just incredible. That scene you're talking about, I'm going to crib from my own review here, but it was like the CBeebies bedtime story from hell, like it was just absolutely horrifying, but so funny. And then I actually thought he was, you know, believably imposing as a character as well, because you're supposed to believe that he has the ability to slay gods. He's only one man, but the reason that he's able to do that is because he's able to summon these really freaky sort of shadow monsters. So he has these army of creatures that sort of back him up in battle, basically, and he can send out these tendrils to keep people pinned to the ground. And then he's also able to sort of teleport as well in the shadows, which makes him feel almost unstoppable, even when you've got Thor and the mighty Thor and Valkyrie sort of fighting him simultaneously. It actually feels like there is some kind of threat there. But I thought Bale was terrific. When you have Christian Bale in a comic book film, you expect him to be a bit somber, a bit straight, add a bit of gravitas. But actually, he was totally on Taika Waititi's wavelength. I thought he just totally got
he totally got the memo, didn't he?
Yeah, he got the memo. He knew exactly what he was doing, exactly what the part he was playing. There is a sort of interesting, I guess you would call it a sort of pre-title sequence involving him as well, which we won't go into too much detail on, but almost feels like a slightly different version of Gore, which I found quite interesting. That's what I was thinking, oh, is this what Gore's going to be like? But then when he sort of almost snaps and goes a bit psychotic and just crazy, then I was like, oh yeah, now we're on. This is what I wanted from Christian Bale as a villain in a Thor film, you know?
And it's kind of impossible not to sort of compare him to Christopher Eccleston in The Dark World. You know, they're sort of these pale British actors with their pale makeup on, you know, trying to bring hell and damnation to Thor and his world, and not a patch on him, I'm afraid. So, Christian Bale has blown the doors off it, hasn't he? The next baddie's going to have to be pretty spectacular.
Yeah, he looks like he's enjoying himself a lot more than Eccleston did. And his appearance is a lot more threatening as well. Eccleston looked a bit like a Teletubby, kind of beefed up.
Teletubby.
Bale, like, nightmarish. It's great makeup. I was really fascinated looking at his scars and
his
costume.
Horrible black mouth as well. Like, that was a disgusting touch, that when he opens his mouth, it's just all sort of disgusting black sort of slick inside there. And I love that idea as well, that the world that he inhabits, you know, no spoilers on what sort of motivating him, but the world that he inhabits is this world of shadows where there is no colour. And so when Thor and Jane and anyone else with their sort of literal comic book colours enter that realm, that colour is sapped from them. And it's such a really good representation of what he's trying to do. He's trying to take the colour from the world. He's trying to take the joy. He's trying to take hope from the world that gods provide to people. Obviously, his motivation is very different and he thinks he's doing a very different job. But I really like that. I thought that worked really well. Let's talk about Taika Waititi. He is obviously back as a narrator. So his narration is absolutely brilliant. But also he is throwing these things in that are so typically Taika, like the soundtrack, the Guns N' Roses soundtrack, which is just absolutely spot on. I really love the idea of thinking about Taika having a chat with, you know, Axl Rose about this. And then there's like these little furry like owl people that are on speeder bikes, and I would like to use your tune here. Which, speaking of those, there's some really good sort of Jim Henson type creatures that are brilliant and hysterical, and I love those. Really felt very 80s. But yeah, so we've got a great soundtrack, which Taika does. We've got this irreverence. We obviously have, as you mentioned earlier, the Guardians of the Galaxy that turn up for a little comedic aside. What else did you love? I mean, I have to mention the goats. Love a screaming goat. I will watch a screaming goat video and laugh every single time at those. So for the goats to be screaming goats and to scream throughout the film just had me in stitches. And it's such a stupid, dumb, throwaway joke, but totally works. Did you like the goats?
Oh, I love the goats. Yeah, they never grew old for me. Every time they turned up and screamed. It's just a great visual as well. These two goats towing this huge boat around the cosmos on the...
That's got a tiki bar on it.
Rainbow Bridge. Yeah, it's a real sort of comic booky, like, makes no sense image, but just looks absolutely fantastic.
The goats towing the barge actually comes from Norse mythology, believe it or not.
Does it? Oh, wow.
But are they screaming goats in Norse mythology?
I don't know if they're screaming. I don't know if that's specified.
Are they screaming goats?
Yeah, for me, this just felt like Taika, like, fully unleashed, because, of course, Ragnarok wasn't written by him. He was just the director. But you could feel, you know, Taika's fingerprints all over Ragnarok. But in this, it just feels like this is him completely off the chain now. It's 100% a Taika movie at this point. Just every element, just totally imbued with his sensibility and style, his zaniness, his wackiness. And it just felt a bit more heartfelt than Ragnarok to me. You have this running element through the film where a group of Asgardian children are kidnapped by Gore. And then that has a really terrific payoff sort of towards the end. It feels like the fact that, you know, Chris Hemsworth, Natalie Portman, Christian Bale, Taika Waititi, all their children are actually in this film. Yes. It feels like a real sort of family affair. It feels like parents making a film sort of for their children, with their children. I found all that side of it just really actually quite sweet and quite endearing in a way that sort of took me off guard a little, because I was expecting something very silly, but I wasn't expecting something quite so emotional by the end.
Yeah, indeed. And Chris Hemsworth's wife turns up as the wolf lady that he has a brief affair with. Yeah, so it is a totally family affair.
The wolf lady on a lady wolf.
But yes, indeed, which you have to see that to understand what on earth is going on there. Let's talk about Chris Hemsworth then. You know, he's got Spiderhead out at the moment on Netflix. This is him doing his thing, but really leaning into his comedic sensibilities, which he's so good at. I laughed like a drain at some of the stuff he was doing. And how does he do that? Completely earnest, completely dumb, but completely delightful thing. I find it amazing. It's a delight to watch, isn't it?
Yeah, he's reached his comic zenith here. He's just so good as Thor at this point. Like, he just knows this character inside out. In Taika Waititi, he's kind of found the perfect partner who also totally gets that sense of humor, that sort of slightly wry, deadpan, but hysterically silly and funny kind of sense of humor. I just thought he was exceptional in this film, even more so than Ragnarok, where you still have the leftover elements of his more sort of stoic Thor. Here he's just basically a pure comedy character, and yeah. I just thought, oh, this is exactly what I want from Thor at this point. You've had the very serious universe-saving Thor in Infinity War and Endgame very recently. Let's just have comedy Thor, because I enjoy him so much.
Yeah, who gets naked and makes men and women faint around him. He tosses his coat off and it falls over somebody's head or something. You know, like, everything he does is ridiculous and really endearing.
Yeah, I love the moment where he first sort of meets Jane again, and Jane is dressed as Thor, and he starts to feel sort of very insecure, and he just manifests like this giant ridiculous mask just because he can, because that's who he is. He's just very, very insecure in that way. Very, very funny. And obviously he's great when it comes to all the action stuff as well. There's a lot of eye-popping visuals here in terms of axe throwing and lightning summoning and
roundhouse
things
kicking
out of the air and, yeah, splits. You get it all.
Yeah. I think we're probably saying this is a really good time at the cinema, right? This is what, you know, the movies was made for, going with your popcorn and your mates and having a good old laugh and also possibly a little cry.
Yeah, it's so fun. I laughed like a drain throughout the whole thing. Had such a good time with it. For me, it's my favorite thing that Marvel have put out in Phase 4. So since Endgame, it just hit all the right notes for me.
Matthew?
I did like it a lot. I was a bit underwhelmed generally because I felt like...
Come on. Kind of... Go on then, explain yourself.
Explain myself. Yeah, because I mean, it's essentially Ragnarok 2.0. So I felt it lacked a bit of the freshness that you got with that. You know, it felt like more of the same, which is great in itself. But I was kind of looking for it to push the needle a bit further. And I found that some of the dramatic elements jarred a bit with the comedy, even though, I mean, there's a subplot with one of the characters that is drawn directly from the comics, but I felt that perhaps got a little bit of short shrift. And every time it kind of went to a dramatic moment, you knew it wasn't long before you'd go back to a belly laugh or a visual gag. So I felt like the stakes got a little bit low there.
Mm. And I suppose, I mean, a little tiny peeve was that I didn't get enough Tessa Thompson. I feel like Valkyrie's a cracking character, and I really enjoyed her arc in Ragnarok. But here, she's very much just along with the gang and sort of facilitating the story of Thor and Jane rather than really driving anything herself, which is a great shame. Although the other thing that she does do, which she did in the previous films, is she represents, diversity and sexual orientation and whatever else. And there's a lot of that in here. No spoilers, but there is a sort of incident with a particular character that has changed their identity. And that is, handled with love and acceptance and absolute, loveliness. And I think that that's also incredibly interesting about a Marvel film, that it is driving that conversation as well. We're saying definitely go and see it. And obviously, when you go and see it, a big question, should you stay beyond the end titles? How many little sneaky Easter eggy things do we get, Jordan?
Well, all I'll say is stick around to the bitter end and you won't be disappointed.
Okay, so if you fancy a bit of Thor Love and Thunder, it is out in cinemas this Friday. See it with a great sound system so you can really enjoy that Guns N' Roses. And if you want to hear more about Thor Love and Thunder, we will be doing a spoiler cast in the next few weeks when we'll be talking about that and that and when they did that and that bit at the end. So come back for that. So from Jane Foster to Jane Austen now with this.
I almost got married once. There were no two souls more in rhythm than Wentworth and I. And I was persuaded by my family to give him up. My father.
Exquisite jawline.
He's never met a reflective surface he didn't like. And my sisters.
I'm just too kind, Anne, that's my problem. I give all of my attention to others and then I suffer for it.
Where are your children?
How should I know?
I would have been a far happier woman in keeping him than I have been in giving him up.
It's been 7 years.
8.
Darling, at some point, you have to move on.
So this is Persuasion, the last completed novel from Jane Austen, adapted for Netflix with Dakota Johnson leading. How have they made this different, Matthew?
It's a bit like Fleabag. That's kind of the main difference. Jane Austen's Fleabag with the fourth wall breaking and to camera asides. There's a bit more innuendo as well in this as well.
Yes, about hiding your light under a bushel.
On the one hand, it's sort of your classic Jane Austen plot with a love triangle and social climbing, big families,
annoying relatives,
the patriarch. Including Richard E. Grant as the patriarch, who kind of dips in and out and drops some killer one-liners. There's lots of wittiness, lots of romance, lovely costumes. Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty solid Jane Austen adaptation, really, sort of comparable, I suppose, to the Emma with Anya Taylor-Joy, but just with a slight more self-awareness, a bit more sort of postmodern, I suppose, with all that kind of to-camera business going on.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's obviously the story of Anne Elliot, who at the ripe old age of 24 is an old maid and has been persuaded to give up her engagement to Captain Wentworth, who's played by Cosmo Jarvis, who we last saw in Calm with Horses. And then she's very, very upset about this, isn't she? She is thinking that her decision was wrong. And just as he comes back into her life and they sort of circle each other as exes, another young gentleman arrives in the shape of Henry Golding. Now, I don't know, did you like the flea bagging of Jane Austen? Does this character require that, Jordan?
Not really. It made the whole thing just feel like too snarky and too almost too modern in a way. If I'm watching like a period romance, like a Jane Austen adaptation, I don't want it to feel like it's been made in 2022, you know? I want to be transported. I don't want to be reminded of Phoebe Waller-Bridge and that show. Yeah, that whole element of it just jarred with me right from the start, to be honest, as did Dakota Johnson's accent, which I thought needed a lot more work. She didn't strike me as a particularly convincing British lady. Very little of this worked for me, to be honest. I don't want to be too much of a downer. I sort of didn't really buy the chemistry between Cosmo Jarvis and Dakota Johnson. Well, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know if Cosmo was particularly well cast in this role either. I think he could be great in the right role. He's so good in Calm with Horses. But here, I just didn't like the fact, you know, he's sort of from the Tom Hardy school of mumbly acting, you know, and that just didn't sit right with me for someone who is supposed to be this sort of dashing Navy man. Even the sort of central romance didn't work for me. Like, you expect that to work in a Jane Austen adaptation, but yeah, that even that fell flat.
Yeah, it also relies on the fact that you really want it to work out with Wentworth rather than her new suitor. And unfortunately, you've got Henry Golding charming his way across the screen and doing a lot more sort of chemistry and sort of sizzle with Johnson than Jarvis is doing. So it's like, oh my God, I actually not bothered if she gets back with her ex or whether she goes off with this guy. And that's not really the intention of this.
That classic Austin sparring that you want, don't you? Mr. Darcy. And
yeah, I mean, when you think about the steam that Keira Knightley and Matthew McFadden created as Elizabeth Bennet and Mr. Darcy, you know, snapping at each other in the rain, and you're like, when will you kiss? There's none of that here, is there? And for me, I think Jo Wright's Pride and Prejudice is the benchmark of doing Austin with a modern twist, but in no way, you know, losing the essence of her. And this just really felt like it had taken Austin as a starting point to do a sort of snarky Bridget Jones updatey kind of thing. It really didn't work for me. And as you say, you know what I'm like about wigs and accents, and Dakota's accent just kept ebbing and flowing, and I could hear her, and she's so charming as an actress. I love her. You know I do. So when you know what she sounds like, she has to sound so very perfectly right as a British, you know, heroine there for you not to be able to hear that sort of California laid back accent that she has. And it's just creeping in there. So it takes you out of it all the time. Did you enjoy Richard E. Grant? He's obviously had a bit of a resurgence with Jamie. And here he is, you know, being a waspish father who is only interested in pictures of himself.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, some of his lines were just pure wit nail when he goes, put on your finest frocks. Every time he showed up, I thought he really kind of buoyed up the energy.
Could have done with more, really.
Comedic edge it needed.
Absolutely.
I mean, I don't know how much he's in the original novel, but yeah, I certainly would have liked more of him.
So I think we're saying it's good that this is on Netflix, right? You can watch it with a curry. You didn't have to leave the house for it. And that's probably what it's good for.
Yeah, it's where it belongs.
Persuasion is in cinemas this week. Hits Netflix next week on the 15th. It's time for alternative line reading. As usual, this is a line by somebody we've discussed already on the pod in a different film in the wrong accent or cadence. I'm going to try and do it in Russell Crowe's very sort of voluptuous Greek accent. Okay. I feel lethal on the verge of frenzy. I think my mask of sanity is about to slip. I think that was more Italian, but there you go. Who says that?
Definitely, yeah. Sounds very familiar.
Is it Natalie Portman?
Nope.
Not Black Swan.
It isn't, but it is somebody also having a fracturing experience in their psyche.
Mm. Oh, is it Christian Bale in something? He does a lot of fracturing. Yeah.
Come on.
It's not one of the Dark Knight films, is it?
No. It has Mask of Sanity.
American Psycho.
Oh, American Psycho.
Yes, American Psycho. Oh, yeah. And it sounds like this.
I have all the characteristics of a human being. Flesh, blood, skin, hair. But not a single clear, identifiable emotion, except for greed and disgust. Something horrible is happening inside of me, and I don't know why. My nightly bloodlust has overflowed into my days. I feel lethal, on the verge of frenzy. I think my mask of sanity is about to slip.
It's time to move on to our final film this week. It's this. Imagine me and you,
I do. I never thought I'd make anything as amazing as Charles.
You built my body.
I built his body.
And my tummy is a washing machine.
And his tummy is a washing machine. So happy
together. Should show him to people. Why not? I should call
you up. And what you want for him? At least not for Sam.
Why are you wearing that?
I feel pretty cool, man. Imagine. I want to go on an adventure. Everything is lovely.
It's not all lovely.
Stay down, boy.
There's a big old world out there. A big perilous world.
Oh my gosh.
Okay.
What was that?
Okay.
Perilous. So
just
very
birds.
Perilous.
So this is Brian and Charles, the gentle story of one lonely man inventing a robot and finding that that companionship opens up him to the possibilities of romance and emotional evolution and cabbages and endless cups of tea. Jordan and I saw this British mockumentary at Sundance and we loved it. And now it's coming to a big screen near you. Jordan, give us a little top line, log line of what this is about.
Brian is an inventor. He lives in an unspecified sort of Welsh village. He makes things like an acorn handbag and an egg belt, which are just amazing as they sound.
A flying clock.
A flying clock, which allows people to look up into the sky and tell what time it is. Just ingenious, ingenious. Although it turns out he is actually a bit of a genius because he manages to one day successfully create a sentient robot. Played by Chris Hayward, out of spare bits in his garage, like a washing machine and a mannequin head. So he's very sort of ramshackle in a very sort of charming way, in a way that goes from like a complete full circle from absolutely terrible to absolutely amazing, the design of Charles. There's a little bit of sort of E.T. and Elliot in the early scenes with this sort of very trepidatious and frightened robot emerging into the world and sneaking around in the dark. And eventually Brian sort of coaxes the character that is to become Charles into his house. And then after a night reading the dictionary, Charles learns to speak and he chooses the name Charles Petrescu, a name that never fails to make me laugh. Just one of the great modern movie names. Brian is sort of completely enamored with Charles. They quickly become very good friends. Charles is very curious. He loves cabbages. And eventually he wants to sort of expand his horizons and explore the world. And at the same time, Charles helps Brian to break the ice with a woman called Hazel, who lives in the village, who's his sort of very timid sort of love interest. And then you also have this element of danger in the hills in the form of this sort of comically nasty local family led by the bullying dad, Eddie. Because Brian knows that Charles won't be safe if they discover that Charles exists. So he does everything to keep him hidden. But Charles's desire to sort of explore the world means that Brian can't keep him inside forever, essentially. So it's this very sort of whimsical, almost magical realist story told in this mockumentary style, to in a sense that we're supposed to believe this is actually happening and this is real.
So before we talk about how successful it is, let's take a listen to what David Earle, who plays Brian, and Chris Hayward, who plays robot Charles Petrescu, had to say about the project when I sat down with them to talk Rubber Veg, Mad Inventions, and possible sequels. David and Chris, welcome to Inside Total Film.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So obviously I wanted to ask you sort of about Brian and Charles being part of this genre of man-robot friendships that, you know, audiences really love. We really buy into that idea of sort of falling in love with an inanimate object that is given a sort of soul, as it were. So why do you think people like that idea? And where does this film sit within other great man-robot films?
Yeah, it's a good point, isn't it? I guess it's almost like, it's a little bit like an imaginary friend almost. I mean, for us, it just originated because we were doing it as a stand-up show.
Yeah.
And it was just funny having Brian have this bizarre companion, because it didn't make him seem any more normal. It seemed Brian made him look even weirder. He'd have, this is his best friend, was this bizarre looking mannequin robot. Yeah, but why there is a slight fascination between that, I'm not sure.
I had two imaginary friends when I was growing up.
Did you? What were their names?
Pulu and Bumpy.
Which did you prefer?
Yeah, did you play them off?
Did you fall out with any of them?
I was quite keen on Bumpy as a ghost.
Who wouldn't be?
He sounds brilliant. So tell me about developing this character. Obviously, Brian was a radio sort of character and then and a stand-up character. And then Charles came into this as this sort of robot. How did that sort of develop and how did the look of him develop? I mean, he's very bizarre looking and in a brilliant fashion. How did you come up with that?
So it started with David doing his internet radio show. Our producer, Rupert Magendy, called in. He used this computer software to speak out what he typed. And one of the voices was Charles. And I was listening to it. I really loved it. I wanted to build the costume of Charles. So then we started doing it as a live show, the three of us, as Brian and Charles. When I made the costume, I just wanted something to look really stupid. And doing on stage, I just wanted it to be big and preposterous looking. And we didn't think any more than that, really. We just wanted to have a really ridiculous, funny show.
Did it look sort of like the one we see in the film now, or have you finessed that look?
Yeah, for the most part, he's pretty much the same. In the film, he's a little bit more handsome because the mannequin heads that we got were a little bit more tanned and handsome than the original that I found on eBay. But for the most part, and his eyebrows in this one are less bushy. The original one, he had quite big Patrick Moore style grey eyebrows.
Yeah.
We gave him a trim for the film.
Yeah. I know the two of you, when you were sort of, you got on this film and you were ad-libbing a lot and using sort of improv, how did that work? Was it just that you just were let go and you were able to sort of interpret the script, or did you do the script and then had a go with different sort of options of it? How did that work for you, David? You've obviously worked with Ricky Gervais on Derek and Afterlife. Were there aspects of that you brought into this process?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely improvise a lot on those shows. I mean, Ricky's always written a script, but he let me go off on one if I have an idea. So with this, I guess it's sort of same sort of thing. We definitely had a script there, which we followed. But, you know, if there was time, we would play around with it. And there were some scenes that were just completely improvised, like walking to the van and Charles wanting to sit in the front seat. I think we sort of felt like we didn't need a script, didn't need dialogue. Just felt like we just wanted to watch them bicker. Where I see where Brian introduces the inventions, that was all improvised, most of it anyway, because I hadn't seen any of them before. So Jim wanted to do it like that. Jim wanted to see what my reaction would be to like a chicken on a spoon or whatever.
Yeah. And did you make up what those inventions were, or were they devised as inventions that you had to sort of interpret? Or were you just like, it's a chicken on a spoon, so therefore I'm going to say it's a whatever it is. How did that work? Because there's some brilliant inventions in that shed.
We came up with the egg belt, didn't we, Chris?
Egg belt and pinecone bag were in there from the beginning. And then the other ones are the helmet and the ping pong, picky pong, ping pong pie, the puzzle. David just said that off the top of his head. And there were quite a few. We didn't use all of them. We had quite a few in there that we had to just, we couldn't have them all in there. But there were quite a few just bizarre looking things that, off the top of his head, he had to say what it was.
Tell me about being in the robot suit all day. Did you put a call in to Anthony Daniels to talk about the horrors of being in a robot suit?
It's just quite stuffy in there. You just can't see anything. I'm kind of useless when I'm in there because I have to be led around by people. And it's like looking after a doddery old man, I think, because I have to be, two people have to help me sit down because I can't see anything. Yeah, and I was always tripping up and bumping into things. The main bit was between takes, I was just a bit bored because I had to stay in the costume sometimes. So I'd just be sat in the chair. No one would really be talking to me.
This has really opened my eyes. I completely forgot about your side of things. I really feel for you now.
Oh, thanks, David.
Feel guilty about not engaging.
I do. It's just like, well, he's got a plastic chair to sit on. He's fine.
But... he's got a chair to sit on.
Tell me about the cabbages. Obviously a big thing for Charles. Why that vegetable and how many did you go through on set?
Cabbage.
I know we use it in the short and it just seemed funny. And then obviously once we'd referenced it once, it was too hard not to reference it a few more times. And the next thing you know, you've got something, you kind of have to do something with it. There were quite a few real ones. I think there were about 10 real ones and about 5 rubber ones.
And sort of special effects as well at the end.
Yeah, there's some CGI ones. No spoilers. See if you can spot the CGI cabbages.
Okay, so, yeah, this is one for the director's cut. Tell me about the catchphrases that you... The catchphrases presumably came from your sort of first iteration when you're doing him on stage, but were there catchphrases that sort of caught on set when you were filming? Because obviously they are in our office.
Oh, which ones?
I mean, we just... Charles Pacescu, we say to most things.
Yeah. Also things like when he says, "You built my body," that sort of line. Yeah. We use that in the short. I think we even did that in the live show, actually. Mm-hmm. We just sort of kept using certain phrases.
He would say a word that would just make us laugh, just tickle us. We'd go, right, just keep saying that word. Keep saying.
Yeah, him just repeating anything is... Yeah. He could say anything on repeat and it'd be funny.
Yes, it's true. It's true. The film sort of, it's had really great reviews out of Sundance, and people are just loving it and really finding it very warm and really emotional. And, you know, it can be viewed as a study of loneliness or the power of companionship or about raising a child and letting a child go out into the world or looking after a parent that's ailing. What do you see it as, or what do you see the sort of tone of this and the message of this?
The father and son thing is a definite one for me, because I've got boys, and when we were writing it, my eldest was 14 or 15, so that's a definite one for me, letting go. Definite one for him when he watches, my son watched it, he felt it. We kind of spoke about the elderly parent as well, didn't we, Chris? We didn't really overthink it, we just wanted to tell this story, and then just whatever people bring to it, they bring to it, you know, they project their own stuff onto it.
People are always going to interpret it in different ways. And it's just quite interesting to see how people, what they do, read into it. I think there's a bit of Charles in me that is always looking to run away and just go off. I'd like to just go off on holiday all the time.
You also filmed this in Wales during lockdown. Well, quite harsh Welsh lockdown. And it does feel like this film is very much a product of the sort of experience we all had being locked in a house with one other person that you perhaps never intended to spend that many weeks with. Do you think it sort of really speaks to people on that level as well?
Yeah, I think undoubtedly, yeah. I mean, obviously we wrote it before all that happened. So that's just a bit of a strange coincidence, really. But yeah, I mean, it does have a lot of strange comparisons to that time.
Is there a possibility for a sequel for Charles? Could we see more of his adventures? Because I think we'd love to know where he went on his travels and what he got up to.
I mean, I'd love to. I've got this thought that Brian builds him a girlfriend, and that there's a scene where Charles and the girlfriend are sort of sat on bed together, and Brian's sort of looking through the crack in the door, and Charles is sort of asking her, "Would you like me to kiss you?" He's about that.
Don't really jump the shark.
Yeah.
She's about that big. She's got a Barry White voice.
It's tender.
They're really tender, and they really respect one another, and they sleep in separate beds.
Like an old, really old-fashioned dating.
Oh, I'd totally buy a ticket for that. Please make that. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Can you please get on with that and make that? I think it would be amazing.
Yeah, and she's sort of whizzing around the house, just sort of throwing her away.
and the whole parent sort of issue of, you know, do you let your children sleep under the same roof and with their girlfriend, boyfriend, and the anxiety of a sex talk? I think it would be great. Who knows? You could get into all sorts of discussion on hoses.
Yeah, wearing condoms and stuff. Do you need to wear condoms, Charles? Yeah.
Sounds brilliant.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for your time. And thank you for this just delightful film. It really is an absolute heartwarmer. So that was David Earle and Chris Hayward talking about Brian and Charles. So Jordan, tell us, did you like this movie?
I just found this sort of endlessly charming, endlessly sweet, really, really funny. Charles, for me, instantly became one of the all-time great movie robots after sort of one viewing of this film. He's just absolutely amazing. His voice is this really old school sort of text-to-speech software. So it's all sort of monotone, completely flat. And somehow that just makes it all of his lines 10 times funnier than they would have been with just a normal voice actor. The performance is great as well. He moves in a very sort of awkward way. But the fact that he sort of has this pneumatic neck, which sort of pops out whenever he's excited. He sort of shakes a bit when he's scared. He dances. He sort of does a weird little jig when he's happy. Just everything about the physical performance was great as well. Yeah, I just absolutely love Charles. I wish I could have my own Charles. He's amazing.
Yeah, agreed. It's very sweet. And you can read anything into this sort of film. You could read it as... you know, a little study of parenthood and, you know, the desire of parents to protect their children, and but that ultimately you have to let them fly. You know, people have said that it's a comment on looking after an elderly parent and sort of the sort of ridiculousness of some of the things you get up to trying to stop a parent from doing things with a parent with dementia or something else. What did you take from it, Matthew? Did you see those parallels?
It felt like a sort of Wallace and Gromit meets Pinocchio for me, or Chappie. It did remind me quite a lot of Chappie, yeah, with the whole sort of emphasis on speech and the kind of the child, his childlike nature, and when the villains kind of come to prominence. I thought that was the most successful part of it, really, the kind of tension they bring, because they are really nasty and unpleasant, and you really sort of sense how vulnerable the other characters are when they're kind of circling them, and they're always kind of in the background as well. And there's like a horrible little incident in the local shop, which kind of stayed with me for a bit. So yeah, I did like those characters. So I felt at times it was maybe a little bit twee, especially like in the early going. But once that element came into it, I was much more on board with it.
Oh, I totally liked the tweeness of it. And I like that sort of the office sort of style, you know, fly on the wall kind of element of it. And that Brian just sort of chats away to the camera and reveals a lot about himself in a sort of a la David Brent way, that it's not really what he does say, it's what he doesn't say that gives away his character. I really liked it. I thought it was so funny, so charming. I totally bought it. I was just like, yeah, this is happening. This man does live in Wales and is a bit of a strange creator man who actually has managed to bring this robot to life. And there's a fantastic scene when the gas man comes to read the meter and Charles hides, that it's just so deceptively simple and yet made me laugh so much. I think it's just a really assured and sort of clever use of comedy and sort of social realism, and also just that genuine relationship being built on screen as it goes along. I thought it was absolutely delightful.
I was a bit confused by the mockumentary thing though, because it felt like they kind of dropped it halfway through, and I wasn't really sure like who was meant to be filming this documentary. What was it for? You didn't sort of get that sense, and then felt like it was there and it was convenient, but then eventually the rest of the story took over and it was kind of fell away. So I wasn't quite sure if that was really integral to it.
Yeah, now you said that, I realised that did happen. But at the time watching it, I didn't care, I don't think.
I saw it again recently, having first seen it at Sundance back in January, and I just completely forgotten that it was a mockumentary. Yeah. And then when the mockumentary style came in on the second view, and I was like, oh yeah, this was a mockumentary. That element of it's not really that important. I wouldn't get too hung up on it, but it's just a stylistic device.
Yeah,
it works well enough.
Why is it there? Yeah.
I guess it's just an introduction to those characters, and like that. Why would you have a window in on their existence? Unless somebody found it strange.
It just made the tone feel a bit uncertain to me. Like they kind of started with this idea and then thought, this isn't really working. Let's ditch it and go in a different direction. So it just made it a bit uneven for me.
Did you not love Cabbages and Charles Petrescu? Charles Petrescu. You built my body.
I liked Louise Brealey as well, which was good. Former TF contributor, Louise Brealey.
Yes, indeed. Wow. She is. She's one of ours.
Held her own.
Indeed. Okay, so would we suggest that people go and see this at the cinema? Is this something that you need to see on a big screen, and will it bring joy to your heart?
I mean, I don't think it would lose a huge amount on the small screen, but it is a crowd pleaser, so I think it would gain from being seen with a lot of people kind of laughing along and cheering it along.
Cool.
Yeah, completely agree with that. If you can find a screening in between the umpteenth showing of Thor, Love and Thunder, definitely seek it out.
It's a good companion piece to that, isn't it? You know, you've got Thor's relationship with, you know, his weapons. And here we've got, you know, Brian's relationship with his strange devices. I think they sit very well together. I think they'd be a good double bill.
I'd like to see a crossover with Korg and Charles going on an adventure.
Oh, that would be great.
Carnage.
Yeah, so obviously, you know, David has suggested a sequel, but maybe that's the threequel, you know, Korg and Charles sending postcards back from their various places they go.
If they want to bring Brian and Charles into the MCU, that's the way to go.
I could see that happening. I think there's a place for them. It wouldn't surprise me.
Charles Petrescu would be fine on a Guardians of the Galaxy ship, I think. Yeah. He'd blend in with everyone else.
Yeah.
You know, I think Groot would enjoy him.
Yeah, stop getting my hopes up. Like, this sounds too good, and it's never going to happen.
Yes.
You can have that suggestion for free, Marvel. Okay, so that is Brian and Charles, and that is out in cinemas today. So that is it for this week's episode. What is your film of the week, Jordan?
Ooh, that's a tough one, because I really did enjoy Thor, Love and Thunder, but I don't think that needs any more help, so I'm going to go with Brian and Charles.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Matthew?
Thor.
Thor.
Thor, Love and Thunder.
No one's going for Persuasion. I think I would go and say Brian and Charles again. I just love it. I'd take a cabbage. Okay, so we'll be back next week for more. But before we go, there is time for a listener's question. And this one goes with Brian and Charles, I'd say, as well as, I think, Thor. What's the best dance moment in a movie? Matthew.
I'm going to go for Francois Ozon's swimming pool with Charlotte Rampling, who's persuaded to dance in one scene. And she does the kind of most stiff sort of disco moves that you've ever seen, and then eventually kind of warms up. But yeah, I find that very amusing.
Okay. Jordan.
This is really tricky. So many great films. Singing in the Rain, Saturday Night Fever. I'm going to go with Pulp Fiction, the Jackrabbit Slim twist with Uma Thurman and John Travolta. Instantly iconic, much imitated. I think I've seen about, you know, two dozen Halloween costume variants of that scene, despite the fact it's not scary. But yeah, so simple, but so effective. And of course, Travolta returning to hip swinging dance moves after Saturday Night Fever. All very exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. I was for a sort of bleak one. I was going to say Reservoir Dogs and the little shuffle around the room to Steeler's Wheels.
It's a great scene.
Before an absolute horror happens. Just the horror of that, that it's this calm before a storm and you know it's coming. But it's a great track and he's just shimmying around that warehouse. That's a really great one. Also, I love Armie Hammer's little dance on the 80s dance floor in Call Me By Your Name, dancing like nobody's watching, but actually was dancing to no music at all in the middle of a night shoot and felt like an idiot doing it. Can't tell. The magic of cinema. So those are my two. And, you know, there is a dance in Brian and Charles, which is very nice, on a little bit of sort of carpet in the kitchen. And you can probably dance to most of Thor, Love and Thunder because there's that much Guns N' Roses.
That's more of like headbanging, right? Thrashing your hair around.
Yeah. Well, you can dance how you like. You can dance just how the music moves you. Stop being, you know, prescriptive, Jordan.
We didn't mention the Inbetweeners movie. I can't believe it's not
picked. How did we forget that? The Inbetweeners, when they're doing the dance across the flipping disco and they're just dreadful. In fact, I might Google that after this just to enjoy that again because it is amazing. It is. Thank you for reminding us of that, Matthew.
It never stopped giving that moment.
It doesn't. And on that note, shall we say goodbye? Say goodbye, Matthew.
Goodbye.
Say goodbye, Jordan.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me.
Right then, Sally. Looks like the holiday starts here.